Thanks, Moshe. First of all, I'd like to thank Moshe for inviting me to talk today. Now, those who know me know two things about me. First of all, I'm not very mathematical, so it's nice to be here at Fields. And secondly, I'm in corporate finance. I'm not an investments person. So I get into some of the things that I'm talking about mainly from a corporate finance point of view, in particular the material on the market risk premium that I'm going to be talking about. So first of all, I thought I'd like to explain how I got into this, because this is not my sort of normal sort of stuff. Now imagine 4 years ago, April 2000. I'm a tenured full professor, and most of you know we're not exactly entrepreneurs, we're not exactly go-getting, we're pretty conservative sort of people, and I'm no different from other tenured faculty at University of Toronto in that regard. So there I was sitting in my my office, can't remember what I was doing, but someone knocked on the door, they got my name out of U of T's Blue Book, and it was a financial planner. And he said, look, I'm going to make you a fortune. And of course, even full tenured professors sort of perk up a little bit of interest. So I said, okay, how are you going to do that? And he said, we're going to do financial planning on the internet. So he said, look, if eToys can make a fortune, if all of these internet stocks can basically do nothing out of the ordinary and get millions just for a scrap of paper, then we can do some financial planning and we're going to make a lot of money. And that's why I said this is April 2000. So some of you probably know, well, if you're from Chicago, you don't know this, but the rest of us know there was a bubble in internet stocks. And there were fabulous prices in the spring of 2000, and just sort of mentioning eToys, went from a $10.1 billion market cap, bankrupt 18 months later for $20 million. My colleagues from Chicago have a tough time explaining that one. But North Point Communications was an internet, actually a communications company. It actually had some assets, but he went from $5.6 billion to $135 million. So I was sort of wrapped up in this at the time, and I thought, well, I'll give it a try. I'll look at some retirement models and think about seeing whether we can come up with something. So that explains the basic objective of what I'm going to be talking about today, which is that I wanted to come up with a model for practical asset allocation. Now, even I know is that if you're going to do something, you have to have something to sell. And the standard model in finance is a multi-period consumption investment model, where we basically look at the retirement date or the termination date of an individual, work back, solve a sequence of problems. And this is a model developed by Samuelson in discrete time and Merton in continuous time. And the result is what we call a constant asset allocation model. And Samuelson's result is an exact theorem that investment horizons have no effect on your portfolio proportions. So the first thing I came up with was, how can I make a fortune selling something to a venture capitalist when the answer is nothing matters? So even I realize I have to do something to make something matter in terms of looking at asset allocation. And of course, obviously, we all know something does matter. We heard Roger talk this morning about bringing in human capital to explain the asset allocation problem. This just came from McGraw-Hill's website, personalwealth.com. Consider these guidelines for asset allocation, adjusting percentages for your personal risk tolerance, investment horizon, etc. Doesn't mention human capital, but if you're in your 20s or 30s, allocate 70% of your investments to aggressive growth or blue chip stocks, 30% bonds, money markets, etc., etc., what we call your aging bonds rule. So out there, professional financial planners use this heuristic to sort of accommodate risk, your aging bonds rule to adjust for investment horizons of individuals. I was sitting in my office thinking, well, I can't use the standard academic models. I'm not going to get rich on that. So where I was 4 years ago was thinking about how can I come up with a practical asset allocation model to sort of put it on an internet site and convince a venture capitalist to come up with a lot of money for me. But it lasted a few months. The market, as we know, internet stocks bubble boomed and crashed. But my interest sort of persisted for a period of time. So what am I going to talk about today? Well, I'm going to talk about two things. first of all, I'm going to talk about the model that that we came up with. And secondly, I'm going to talk about some of the things that Harry talked about in terms of capital market history. What are the parameters? What are the sort of values that we can use? And some of you may have seen things I've written on risk premiums for the last 10 or 15 years or so, but most of it has been derived from my work in public utility hearings, where we need to know market risk premiums for regulating utilities, not from looking at it from the point of view of investment. So what do we know? Well, we can all count statistics. When we look at risk premiums in the US and Canada, arithmetic simple average returns on the S&P 500 minus Treasury, 6.42% in the US. Same information in Canada, the risk premium is about 4.8% using simple annual average returns. Geometric compound rates of return, the numbers are significantly lower, 4.8 in the US, 3.5 in Canada. And as I'll talk about, we can estimate least squares estimate of the market risk premium by looking at minimizing the variation around the growth rate in personal wealth, which is really what the market risk premium is all about. And that's 6.58 in the US, 5.19 in Canada. And as Roger sure knows, most people know, do we use compound rates of return? Do we use arithmetic rates of return? Approximately, depending upon the underlying distribution, the geometric mean or the compound rate of return is the arithmetic mean minus half the variance. And the U.S. market, standard deviation 20%, variance 4%, half the variance 2%. We get about a 2% difference between the compound rate of return and the arithmetic rate of return. And it just so happened this particular period in the U.S. is exact, but it's never exact. But so there's this 2% difference between arithmetic and compound rates of return. If you're going forward and looking at it in terms of investment horizons, what's the market risk premium depends very much upon what the investment horizon is. If you've got a 70-year investment horizon, you're looking at the compound rate of return. If you've got a 1-year investment horizon, you're looking at the arithmetic. And in between, you're looking at some average between those sort of extremes, depending upon whether you've got a 1 or a 5 or a 10 or a 20-year horizon. So that's the history. Harry talked about the history. When you look at the difference between the U.S. and Canada, there's a difference both on the equity market and the bond market. The difference in the equity market is about 1%. On average, the Canadian markets underperformed the U.S. by about 1%. And there are structural, institutional reasons for that. And the bond market in Canada has overperformed the U.S. market by about 60 basis points. Basically, it means we traditionally had higher interest rates in Canada for reasons we'll get to. Incredibly difficult adding much significance to the average rates of return. Standard errors are pretty large. So we argue a great length about the size of the market risk premium, but a lot of it is judgment given the statistical variation in the underlying returns. So that's the evidence in the U.S. and Canada. I'm a great believer in graphs. Have to admit, I'm not a great believer in statistics. I'm also a great believer in economics, despite what Harry said. You have to understand where this data comes from. I don't know whether it was Paul Samuels who said we only have one history, but clearly we do have only one history, and we have to understand what went on during that period. This is the log of invested wealth in Canada from 1923 through to 2003, December last year. So basically a dollar invested in 1923, what does it compound to? Now, the reason I like looking at these graphs is simply because the slope of the line is basically the average rate of return. So we can look at the equity market, and here, of course, we have the great crash, or the boom up until 29 and then the crash. And then you look at this, and you can sort of eyeball it and say, well, it sort of looks like a constant rate of return. Sort of looks like it's growing at the same rate. Obviously, there's variability around this growth rate, but it's difficult to say that the equity market has shown any structural breaks. Bond market, on the other hand, difficult to say that it's constant, because you look at this graph and you can see sort of one growth rate out to about here, and then you can see some sort of structural break around about here. And when we look at risk premiums, we're looking primarily at bonds versus equities, not money markets, when we're looking at trying to forecast what's going to happen over the next 5 to 10 years. So I tend to believe there's been changes in the risk premium because I look at this and I say, well, something happened around here. What happened? Well, we can actually look directly at what happened because the returns in the bond market are just affected by market interest rates, market yields. And this is just a graph going back to 1936 of the long Canada bond yield, treasury bills, and the rate of inflation in Canada. 1936, the Bank of Canada was established. And you can see a number of things, what's happened in Canada. You can see, for example, almost no variability in the long Canada rate and the T-bill rate up until the early 50s. In fact, everything we learn in the textbooks about the Fisher effect, about interest rates responding to inflationary expectations, certainly didn't hold in the 1930s. Why didn't it hold? Well, because we didn't use monetary policy in the way that we now use it. We used allocations of credit rather than using interest rates to allocate credit. And so we see this huge variability in inflation during the recession, depression. No impact of inflation on interest rates because they were controlled. Then starting in the early 50s, we saw dramatic changes. The Bank of Canada basically introduced changes to make the money market in Canada, the bond market, more liquid so that it could actually use monetary policy in the early 50s. And since then, we had this dramatic run-up in interest rates, dramatic run-up in inflation. As everyone in this room knows, interest rates go up, bond prices go down, so realized returns are less than were anticipated. I testify in public utilities. I used to testify against an expert witness working, quote, on the other side, whose data always finished in 1981. And the reason for it finishing in 1981, interest rates were at their peak, realized bond returns were at the lowest possible, market risk premiums, experienced market risk premiums, were the highest possible. And even after we started testifying against each other into the late 80s, into the 90s, he still stopped in 81 on the basis that that's what's in the textbooks and that's what people believe. Well, of course, we know interest rates peaked in 81 because of the fears of inflation. And since 81, we've had a dramatic drop in interest rates because we've had a dramatic drop in inflation. And since then, realized bond returns have vastly exceeded those were anticipated. So we've got this third period here of declining interest rates and realized risk premiums on bonds that have actually exceeded in some years those on equities. So we can look at bonds and we can understand these three distinct periods in terms of the bond market, which should inform us in terms of what's happened to the market risk premium. Another way of looking at this is that we can look at the relative risk of equity versus bonds. Just look, and this is just a standard deviation of 10-year rates of return updated each year as you get another year of data. And when you go back to the 30s and 40s, bonds were risk-free, not just in the terms of the government of Canada always paid off, but they just didn't vary very much because interest rates didn't vary very much. So equities were routinely 4 or 5 times riskier than bonds. When you start in the 1950s and you start seeing changes in monetary policy loosening up the bond market, these structural changes basically have reduced the risk of equities relative to bonds. And as some of you probably know, if you look at risk on the basis of the variability in the annual rates of return, the bond market's been almost as risky as the equity market over the last 20, 25 years, which you would expect if institutions and that framework for handling risk has an impact would affect the market risk premium. So that's the change in the relative risk. What's caused the collapse in interest rates over the last 20 years? Equity markets are dominated by a whole bunch of issuers and buyers. The bond market's dominated by the government of Canada. The money market's dominated by T-bills. The bond market's dominated by government of Canada bonds. Very easy to forget the serious financial problems we had in the late 80s, early 90s in Canada. So you look at the chart and on the right-hand side, Stats Canada optimistically adds up all of the borrowing and lending by all sectors of governments and calls it lending. Of course, nearly always it's not lending, it's borrowing, but that's what's on the right-hand chart. It's the surplus or the lending as a percentage of GDP. And in the 90s, when we were going through this tremendous structural adjustment to free trade with the Americans, we had huge deficits in Canada. 10% of GDP. Government was flooding the bond market with Government of Canada bonds. Hardly surprising as a result that we had these serious problems in terms of the riskiness of equities versus bonds. At the top, I've got the real yield, and we had real yields on the inflation index bonds in Canada. They started basically the early 1990s, real yields of about 4.5%. And we've had some return to fiscal sanity in Canada, and 1997, the government moved into surplus in aggregate across provinces and the federal government. And we've been running 1.5 to 2% surpluses of GDP, and at the same time, the real yield on Government of Canada bonds has obviously declined significantly. So looking forward, when you look at this, the historical evidence is equities have outperformed bonds by about 5% in Canada or about 7% in the US. You have to understand what generated that sort of information. Is the equity return stable? I'll talk about that in a few minutes. But certainly the bond return hasn't been stable. There's been very distinct periods when monetary policy has differed in Canada, either through direct credit controls or through loose monetary policy and through tighter monetary policy. And we can pick that up by looking at the real bond yields and the behavior of the government's deficit or surplus as a percentage of GDP. So that's what I look at in terms of what's happened to the market risk premium. The equity market's really difficult to get a handle on. We have good data on U.S. equity markets going back to 1871. This is the Cowles data, and it's straight out of the Journal of Finance. Fisher and Laurie pushed that data back to 1871. And this sort of summarizes some of the things that Harry said in terms of what's happened. How do we predict the future by looking at the past? These are just 10-year average rates return, real rates return on the S&P. And we have had periods when real rates of return for 10-year periods have been negative, or pretty much to zero for a number of periods. And the same here in the 1970s. And here, of course, we have the great run-up in the stock market in the 20s. And here we've had the enormous bull market from the 80s into the 90s, and the not-so-good performance at the end of that. But that's the average rate of return. The volatility, everyone talks about risk in the equity market. If you go back long enough, standard deviation of the rates return over 10 years, similarly updating for every year and then just dropping a year. The great crash really sticks out simply because of the volatility involved in the great stock market crash. But otherwise, the volatility of annual rates return has been around about 15% going back the last 100 years. I find it very difficult to believe the equity market has fundamentally changed over the last 100 years. I do see that the bond market has changed significantly over the last 100 years. And I'll be absolutely honest, if I think one thing academics have sold a pig in a poke is the idea that there's a stable risk premium, because I don't think there has been a stable risk premium. I think the equity market possibly has been stable, the bond market certainly hasn't been stable, and the money market hasn't been stable. And to understand the risk premium, you have to understand monetary policy, and you have to understand government deficits. So what does this mean? I think risk has declined from the 20s and 30s only because that was arbitrarily high because of the great crash. Real rates return about 8.8%, standard deviation 8.5%. Canadian rates have been about 1% lower. I tend to believe risk premiums are in the 4 to 5% range, and that's what I use when I look at asset allocation models going forward. So this has just been a review of what's happened in order to get an idea of how can we allocate between equities and bonds going forward based upon how we think the markets behave. Now, we had dinner last night, and I think Moshe's idea was all of the presenters get together, realize what good guys we are, so we don't criticize each other too badly. But the fundamental question in finance is, what is risk? And in finance, we're wedded to this idea that risk is variability in the annual rates of return. I personally don't believe that that's risk. Risk, if you look in the OED, is the probability of incurring harm. As far as I'm concerned, harm is the fact that I made the bad decision. I mean, the equity market, when it underperforms the bond market, and you talk to a lot of people, that's a much more realistic definition of what risk is. And this is the fundamental issue involved in asset allocation. When you're making investments, what's the chance that you've underperformed the bond market going forward? Well, one significant feature of this is you can look at this information that I just put up. And suppose you go to the U.S. and you say the risk premium is 5.3%. And suppose you say the annual volatility is 19%. Well, we can all go to our normal distribution tables and say, well, that's 0.27 standard deviations below the mean. So what's the chance of underperforming the bond market? Well, it's about 40% on a one-year basis. Going forward, that's not the case. Going forward, risk significantly changes. So think of this very, very simple example. You start out with $100 and the payoff is either plus or minus 50%. So the first year, you can either go to 150 or 50. Second year, still plus or minus 50%. So the second year, you can either go to 225, 75, 75, or 25. Now, this is a standard example we use to show that over time, the distribution is not normal. In the second period, you've got 3 out of 4 chances of falling below the $100 that you start out with. And in fact, as a basic result in statistics, hopefully there's no statisticians here because I don't, as I said, know very much statistics, but it's a standard result in statistics that when you add random variables, no matter what you start out with, they end up being approximately normal. You add all of these random variables, the distribution's normal. Turns out when you multiply them together, the distribution is not normal, it's log normal, which is a skewed distribution. So the log normal basically just says the natural log of the prices are normally distributed. So if you look at the log and you're looking at wealth over some time period, and that future time period is just a product of the 1 plus the rates of return each year, then you look at that wealth in time period T, it's normally distributed with a log of the starting wealth plus the arithmetic rate of return minus half the variance times the time period times the and the distribution is the standard deviation times the square root of time. And Moshe is going to talk more about this in his paper, I'm sure. But that's the distribution of terminal wealth, TP is out into the future. So what happens with time? Well, as I mentioned, if you look at a one-year horizon, it's approximately normal. Doesn't happen to be anywhere close to being approximately normal if you take longer time periods. So this is the distribution where I've arbitrarily restricted it so to 1, so the mean's 1 throughout, and all I'm looking at the change in the distribution around the mean. So the mean's 1 here. And what happens is it becomes more and more skewed, more and more and more log normal. What's happening is a slim possibility of that 80s to 90 boom continuing for 30 to 40 to 50 years and getting these fabulous rates of return is pulling up the distribution, which means the mode, the most likely, is getting squelched down here. We're getting a more and more log normal distribution of terminal wealth. So that has profound implications in terms of the way in which we model financial plans over multiple time periods. What it means is the probability of meeting expectations drops with time because the most likely events with a log normal distribution just get squeezed down and down. So analytic, and all I've done here is I did an analytic and I did Monte Carlo simulation just to sort of show what happens. But with the values from the historic distribution, you've got about a 45% chance there over a one-year horizon of falling below the mean. When you run out 40 to 50 years, you're looking at a 28 to 30% chance of meeting expectations. 70% chance you're going to not meet expectations. You're going to be significantly below. So that's the basic result in terms of financial planning. And this is a bit of a shock to finance people because when you read any finance textbook, the first thing they say is you work out expected cash flows, you work out expected this, expected that, and you discount. But if in fact you're basing your retirement on expected cash flows and expected income, what this tells you is the probability of getting that's not symmetric. It's significantly less than 50-50. The longer you go out into the future, the chance of getting those expected outcomes drops dramatically. The probability of meeting these outcomes, highly dependent upon the variability, the risk of the underlying securities. Obviously, if you put everything in a risk-free index bond, probability is 100%. If you put a mixture of equities and bonds, 10% standard deviation is this line, and then progressively you get riskier and riskier and riskier. Probability of meeting your expected outcomes drops significantly. So although you might be able to put money from the bond market into equities and say the expected rate of return is higher, that market risk premium is higher, the probability of earning that over time drops dramatically. Now, how does that affect retirement problems? Well, my shot at the brass ring was to, or gold ring or whatever, was to try and come up with an asset allocation that was simple. The standard retirement problem everyone here is familiar with, some sort of target level of income, 70% of disposable income at age 65. So what I looked at was a standard problem. I used a real bond yield of 4% at the time, where you needed to earn 6.5%. Now, this is where I differ, and a lot of people in finance differ, with the standard finance model of what risk is. In this case, investing in a 4% bond, quote, is less risk, but how can it be less risky if you can't meet your retirement targets? So, I mean, you invest in the risk-free bond, and the result is you're poor in retirement, and you're living off the government. That's not low risk, as far as I'm concerned. That's, in fact, extremely risky. So, I mean, risk is a question of how you benchmark risk. And the basic model when you're looking at retirement is the risk is not the variability of the annual rates of return. The risk is, can I meet a satisfactory standard of living when I retire? So you've got some sort of target in terms of dollars out there in the future, and you want to know, what's the chance of my meeting those objectives? So clearly you need equities here. Equities increase the expected rate of return. We know that. What I've gone through the last couple of graphs is simply to show that not only do equities increase the expected rate of return, but they give a rise to a highly skewed distribution. Not just increasing variability, but highly skewed distribution. The chance of meeting those expectations drops dramatically as you look long run into the future. So I set up this problem. It was actually set up so that somebody at age 35 couldn't meet their retirement targets based upon the inflation index bond. But if they chose a balanced portfolio, 50% equities, 50% bonds, they could exactly meet their target rate of return. So it looks as if the problem's solved simply by moving into equities. But this shows what happens to the probability of meeting your retirement objectives over this 30-year period based upon equity allocation. So clearly, given the way in which I structured the problem, 4% risk-free rate, you need 6.5%. You've got zero allocation to equities. You're poor in retirement. You can't meet your targets. You're relying upon the state. You move more into equities. Initially, it has very, very little impact because you've got very little extra rate of return, very, very little extra variability, so the chances of getting those really good years just isn't good enough. Starting in this example around about 20% equities, you start to have some possibility of getting a sufficiently good performance so you can meet your targets. And at the 50% equity allocation that would give the expected rate of return to meet the retirement target, turns out the probability is only 40%. So if you meet this balanced portfolio that gives you your target rate of return, it's another way of saying that is, you don't have a 100% chance of getting 70% of your income in retirement. What you do is you have about a 40%, about 38% chance of meeting your retirement targets. So if you're an investment counselor or a personal financial planner and you come along to someone and say, well, okay, balanced portfolio meets your target rate of return, and they say, wonderful, problem solved, and then you say, well, actually you've got about a 35% chance of this happening, and clearly the problem has not been solved. There's a huge element that's been missing. As you increase the equity allocation, you get the benefit of the higher rate of return at the expense of the even more skewed distribution, and eventually tops out here at about 60% chance of meeting retirement targets. So this is one way of looking at retirement problems. you can actually solve this by taking that probability, and this was my chance at the gold ring, by incorporating a chance constraint. Mosher and other people now talk about this as shortfall constraints, but there's a big literature in the 50s looking at what was called chance-constrained programming. You've got some sort of retirement objective or some sort of financial objectives subject to a probability constraint, a chance constraint. So in this case, I just used 30%, because what I suggested was the retirement target not be structured as 70% of income at age 65, but something like 75% probability of 70% income at age 65. So this is just can be converted, given the log normal, into a unit normal distribution, and 30% turns out to be 0.5244 standard deviations to the left of the compound rate of return. And when you solve this to work out, given the rate of return on the stock market that's historically been earned, the risk-free rate, you can solve for any level of wealth to find out the asset allocation that will basically meet that target. So if you go through and look at this, you can say, I want to put as minimal amount of money aside to meet my retirement objectives. So what can I do? Well, given the structure of this problem, one way is to put up all of the money in a risk-free bond. And then you just invest at the inflation index bond. If you take a little bit more risk, put more in the equity market, you don't have to invest quite as much money, because the higher rate of return allows you to expect to meet that retirement target given the probability constraint, the 70% probability constraint. In this case, turns out that around about 80 to 90% equities for this person with a 30-year horizon results in the minimum amount of wealth necessary to meet that retirement objective. Beyond that, the more money you put into equities, it just makes the distribution so skewed that the modal, the most likely chance of meeting that retirement target, drops, and as a result, you fail to meet the 70% probability target. So this is the wealth. What does it mean for asset allocation and the time horizon? Well, I believe asset allocation and time horizon do matter. I don't believe human capital is what's motivating this. If my son came to me and said, I want to spend $2,000 on a stereo next year, would I tell him, put it all in the stock market because the risk premium is 5.5%? Obviously not. On a one-year horizon, I'd also tell him there's a 40% chance that you lose a significant amount of money. Given that probability, if he wants to save that money for a stereo or a car or anything else, anything beyond 5 years for the time horizon, avoid the stock market like a plague. Put the money into bonds, because the probability over that five-year period of meeting your target is just less than if you just put the money into the risk-free bond. Beyond 5 years, the probability of meeting the target can be met with more and more and more equities. So as your investment horizon lengthens, the probability of meeting your retirement targets or any investment target goes up. So time horizon matters. Now, what have I showed? Well, I've showed something my colleagues in financial economics don't like, and I'll explain why and what their criticisms are. But first of all, if you teach financial theory, around about the third lecture, you develop your maximizing expected utility, and a basic result in financial economics, everybody holds equities. It's just a standard result in financial theory. As long as the risk premium is positive, everybody should hold equities. And of course, that doesn't happen. When you actually look at equity portfolios, most people don't hold equities, either directly or indirectly. And why is that? It's because most people's time horizons are way too short to put money into the equity market with any sort of probability or confidence in meeting their objectives. The equity allocation declines with investment horizon. That's what practitioners and professionals tell us. It's what academics have struggled with for the last 5 to 10 years. I tend to believe your age in bonds rule is a bit too conservative, but certainly you shouldn't be putting some 80-year-old in 100% equities, whereas Merton Samuelson result says that's as fine for 80-year-olds as it is for 20-year-olds. Why my colleagues don't like this is because this is what we call a non-expected utility theory model. It's actually putting a huge disutility attached to falling below the retirement targets. And in fact, if you take out the probability constraint, this is just what we call a growth optimal portfolio. You're just maximizing log utility over multiple time periods. The chance constraint modifies downside risk, and in this sense, it's a lot like prospect theory, it's a lot like regret theory. It's something that modifies the expected utility proposition. And in fact, it violates the state independence assumption, which is the utility function is the same in every single state of nature. This is something the economists, well, they like the expected utility theory. Most people don't expect accept state independence of the utility function. But having said that, it's tough convincing economists who are wedded to this multi-period dynamic optimization model that, in fact, you can have deviations from the expected utility theorem, and you can come up with models quite easily that justify the fact that asset allocation depends upon time horizon. Now, Moshe later on is going to tell you that all of this is nonsense and that the time horizon is still invariant when you take short-fall constraints, but we'll talk about that later.